Thank you for coming. I have to say that this presentation has been a long time coming in one respect. I've talked to Patch and several of the people at ACCS about having more things about the college-level experience for people who are connected to ACCS, because there were obviously lots of concerns about getting your school started, but then you realized when they reached 12th grade, what do they do now? And there hadn't been a lot of discussion about where to go from there. And we didn't want to, as New St. Andrews itself didn't want to, have people all dressed up with nowhere to go and not having thought about it, just simply fall into the same old routines and ruts. And so I've encouraged the ACCS board to think about having more sessions about college issues. Because this is the first time I've presented, I was debating over what to present. Do we talk about what you should do to get them ready for college, or what would be the most needful thing? But it seems to me that strategically, what we have to get right from the start is that the principles that you are operating under with respect to classical Christian education, why are you doing classical Christian education? Those principles ought to be the same things that transfer over into the undergraduate experience. That's the reason New St. Andrews exists. So I'm not ashamed to, promote us in that respect, because what we're seeing is the reformation of education, not just at the primary and secondary level. We want the reformation of education broadly. And so we need to rethink, why is it that we tend to have this academic schizophrenia? Why do we say, on the one hand, we're going to give them this great education at the primary and secondary level, and then send them off to do something vocationally? I have this dilemma every year. Parents come to me and they say, so what kind of job can my kid get when they graduate from New St. Andrews? And I become less and less polite. And I basically say, it doesn't matter and I don't care. And the reason is what I'm in the business of doing as an educator is educating. I'm not in the business of vocational technical training. I'm an educator. You're educators. Why didn't you start vocational technical training now in primary grades? I mean, schools do that now, computer stuff and all that. Why don't we start that earlier? Why do we say, well, let's educate them up this far and then send them off to the university to be educated or to be trained? Okay. What we have is a nation full of college graduates who are highly trained and poorly educated. And many of them, this is what I find tragic, many of them had a wonderful secondary education, maybe at a classical Christian school, but there was never the question of, why do we keep doing this? Why do we keep sending them off there? And what I want to present to you, this is too big of an outline to cover adequately today. I wanted to throw these things out here for you to think about, but I want us to think about, why did we get to the place we are now? Why is it that we think that is a natural thing to send them off to get a vocation, a career at the undergraduate level, when up until the 19th century, the late 19th century, no one would have dreamed of doing that? And we would have had the masters as the thing that prepared people. You specialized at that level. You became a master of something. But instead, we've turned undergraduate education, the college experience, into voc-tech training. And we've done a very bad job of that as well, because they can't train people as well as the industries themselves can. And so you leave with a bunch of classroom experience, maybe an internship or something, but not much. And then you're still having to be retrained or prepared on the job to fit into the business that you're jumping into. It's even more important, and I think as educators you ought to recognize this, who is responsible for raising up the next generation of Christian teachers? Whose job is that? We've often in this country since the mid-19th century assumed that government takes care of most things. they're responsible for education, right? Well, you say, no, they're not. But why do we say that colleges are responsible for training up teachers for year schools? Who said that's the norm? You're responsible. You're responsible for that. And if you're responsible, then the question is, what is it that you want to work with when you have that prospect of raising up a new person to take a position within your schools? Do you want them highly trained and poorly educated? Do you want them to have taken all the education methods classes and testing and all of the things that you can get with your education degree? Or do you want them to have substantive knowledge in a field and then you provide them with the things that are distinctive about your schools? Those kinds of questions about who's responsible for these things really is the heart of what I'm trying to talk about here. We're responsible for educating as educators. At a college level, we do not see our job as providing you well-trained teachers. We will give you the raw materials to work with, but we hope that you begin to think about raising up those teachers within your midst through apprenticeship, through the kind of covenantal commitments one makes with another believer in, we will provide, you commit, we commit to each other, and we'll work this together as we raise you up into a teaching position. Obviously, we don't want to have parents paying the dollars that they do to send their kids to your school to have them receive the word from their child that, oh, it's great, we have a student teacher now. Doesn't really know anything, but it's kind of nice because the teacher gets a break. And the parents are going, no, we don't want that either. They don't want just student teachers. They want teachers. They want people who are well prepared. So when you think about what your responsibility is as educators to bring up the next generation of teachers, you don't need to embrace, you should not embrace, the dominant model of teacher training at college, and then you go off and get some kind of little token experience at a school, student teaching, and then somehow that qualifies you to go do something. We need to think much more covenantally about this. But we need to back up first. How did we get to this state? Wherever colleges go, primary and secondary schools are going to follow, in part because that's the stuff that you're going to be working with in the schools. The teachers who are educated at the college level are going to come back and work as teachers at the primary and secondary level. So if we're going to see the development here, we need to see colleges leading by example in how they educate, how they teach, and that's why we need more classical Christian colleges, so that the culture that is developed at the college level, the kind of life a student lives at the college level, is what will naturally overflow into their workplace environment at a Christian school. You want teachers that have had that kind of experience. That experience is very hard to get almost anywhere. And unfortunately, most of the high school level teachers in the classical Christian schools have little time to think about it. You usually only think about the problems of college when your students are maybe taking the entrance exams, or you are in the process of hiring a third grade teacher and you want to know where they went to school. But we usually tend to not think of that as a partnership, and I really encourage you to think more about what is happening at the college level and to encourage what you want at the primary and secondary level to be reflected in some way at the collegiate level also. We have basically embraced this kind of academic schizophrenia where we do have the understanding of education at one level and vocation at another. We're dualistic. The two things tend to be separate. So we have education and then we have job training. And we're not pulling those together as Christians, because Christ is Lord over all of it. We're tending to not pull those things together in an adequate way. If you go back to 1862 and the Morrell Act, what we had was in a sense, the academic civil war in this country. Think about it. We're in the middle of the great conflict in our nation, the war between the states, and Congress passes an act, the Morrell Act, to establish land-grant universities. Now, why would they do that in the middle of the Civil War? What were they thinking? What they were thinking, very clearly, was they did not want Christian schools to have the dominance that they had up to that point. If you were to have gone to college anywhere in this country prior to the 1860s, you would have had a classical Christian liberal arts education with virtually no vocational technical training involved whatsoever. They would have understood that, no, this is for educational purposes. We're training lives, worldview, thinking. We're developing the person so that they can do anything, anywhere, from a Christian worldview. They would have had that kind of sense about them. That's what college was for. But the Unitarians and the secularists driving the Civil War understood better than Christians that if you take the high ground of the college experience and you turn that into this kind of vocational, technical, secularized experience, what you can do is transfer interests from service to God, service to Christ and the church, into service to the state, service to the economy, service to business and industry. At that very point where the Industrial Revolution is starting to gear up, particularly in the North, they're looking at how do we get this sort of engine going? And you cannot get that going when people are thinking like Christians, when they want it to be an idol. If you want to get your idol worshipped, you have to start training people how to worship it. And this is, you know, going back to my earlier statement, this is where I find it so tragic that many Christians are starting, their very first question out of their mouth is, what kind of job can my kid get when they graduate from this particular school? They're thinking just like the folks who passed the Morrell Act wanted them to think. That's exactly what they wanted them to think. They didn't ask, what kind of character will my child have? What kind of worldview will they walk away with? What kind of community will they have grown up in and experienced and have become part of their lives so they were better husbands and mothers and teachers of their own children and leaders in the church? They didn't want that at all. That was the kind of thing that the Morrell Act was explicitly, this is what's scary, it was explicitly designed to help drive away. The famous editor of the New York Tribune and rabid abolitionist, Horace Greeley, said, we need to have seminaries that train people for the captains of industry, just like the Presbyterian colleges have for theirs. You know, it was explicit. He wanted to see that kind of thing where the American civil religion, commitment to the state and to the economy, were the primary interest that you had, and push this Christian stuff to the margins. That's passé. This is the new age, the new industrial revolution, the new America, and they were in the process of doing that. So the transformation occurring at the time of the American Civil War is not just the political upheaval and about slavery and states' rights and all of that. It's about whether or not Christ and Christendom have a place in America. And the attack point was the colleges and universities of this country. So we basically have a move from covenantal faithfulness to American civil religion that takes place beginning in 1862. And it didn't just take place by federal government beginning to fund land-grant institutions in every state. Whenever you hear about Michigan State, usually the universities with the name state in them are often the land-grant institutions. But every state has them, and they were all set aside, federally funded, and trying to get away from the dominance of the Christian community's role in higher education, the Harvards, the Yales, and so on. Morrill Act changes American education radically by shifting the purpose of higher education. It goes from shaping a qualified student's life and character through faithful Christian nurturing to egalitarian vocational technical training. Remember that part of what's going on here, to use Rush Dooney's phrase, is the embrace of education as a kind of messiah. It's the messianic character of American education. What is the chief sin? Ignorance. Ignorance. And they don't mean by that worldview, they mean ignorance in how to get things done. It's about power and economics. So in the messianic character of American education, what they're after is training everybody, because education is the savior of our country. Right? No child left behind. We have to have no child left behind, because if you leave anybody behind, then there's some ignorance there, and therefore evil can grow, because that's the big, you know, evil is the ignorance of the population. No sense about vocation in the biblical sense. What is someone called by God to do? What are lawful vocations for people to pursue? No, it's got to be education at a practical level, because we're building a nation, you know, we're building an empire. We have to have this to promote the American way. And so from 1862 on, a young man would have understood education very differently than prior to 1862. He would have understood it as no longer that nurturing as much as training. And we have that to this day. Again, everyone asks that question anymore, no matter whether they're Christians or pagans. What kind of job? What kind of skills will I have? Will I fit into the marketplace? And we have that kind of anxiety. Just a couple of examples of this transformation taking place just in sheer numbers. In 1870, okay, so we're not quite filling out the western mountain states, but the Midwest, Plain states, and East are now in full swing. There were a total of 563 colleges in the United States in 1870. And they enrolled very few students. That year, Harvard had its largest entering class ever, 200. And the next two largest entering classes were at Yale and Princeton. They had 131 and 110, respectively. Okay. All of these colleges were under 1,000 students, by a bunch. Okay. But in 1862, what we have is the beginning of the sort of growth and egalitarian vision, so we have to start getting everybody into colleges. And today we have about 3,600 colleges and universities, and about 40 of them, I think it is, 30, you know, between 36 and 40 of those have enrollments of over 40,000. Okay. So what we've had is this, just this huge explosion of university education, but almost none of it at a level that anyone saw prior to 1862. Here's the reality check. I'll probably come back to this again later. Here's a reality check. Everything you're doing as educators at your classical Christian schools is way beyond what's happening in the government schools, right? Much better. But not one of your graduates, likely, and virtually very few of NSA's graduates, would even have been admitted to the colleges prior to 1862. We are so down the scale of abilities and understanding of what education is about, we're still climbing up to reach bottom. Right? We're that low. So even our college graduates today would not likely have been admitted to Harvard and Yale in 1870. Yeah? Because the standards were so much higher. Yeah? So we have to be careful we don't compare ourselves to the government schools. We have to compare ourselves to what were Christians doing 150 years ago. Where are we today relative to them? Because if we just grade ourselves on the curve today, we look really good, and we should be embarrassed. by that. How did we get to this point? Again, there's lots of important details here that I can't possibly touch on, but I want to mention that pragmatism, in a sense, is the thing that drove this phenomenon, and it is what drives it today. We think like pragmatists more than we think like Christians. Again, that question of what kind of job will my kid get is that pragmatic question. It's a natural one. Obviously, you want your child to be able to provide and all of those things. But why is that the first one? It's because it's a first priority. And pragmatism basically put us in the position of saying what is practical, what is useful, what gets things done is more important than principle, than theology, than belief. Okay? It's the question of priorities. You know, when we think about what the Scripture says and seek first the kingdom of God, that's not just there because it sounds pious. It's there because a Christian has to think of Christ and his kingdom first, not somewhere down the list. Where's your idol? Where's that idol? Where's the thing you worship? Well, it shows up very quickly by the first kinds of questions you ask. And we need to repent of that all the way down from seminaries and colleges and schools to get away from an embrace of American pragmatism that takes precedent over our Christian faith and how we educate the next generation of our children. But pragmatism was new and popular, and people like William James and John Dewey, George Herbert Mead, Robert Park, so-called Chicago School, were very influential at a critical period in American history, where they began to say, look, we've got all these issues as a country, and we have all these people immigrating, and they have different faiths, and you know, we have all these ethnic traditions that are kind of hitting together. We need to find a common denominator that will unify us. And they believed that you could teach practical skills, again, a dualist mind, you could teach practical skills without any worldview conflicts. Okay? The Indian Hindu can learn computer science as well as the Christian evangelical. Let's just have them level out at that point and we won't have to worry about it. But of course, a dualistic world is at war with Christ. It's at war with the gospel that says Christ is Lord over everything, not just your spiritual little part of your body. It's comprehensive. It's total. It's all-encompassing. And you can't do computer science without Christ if you're a Christian. It just doesn't make it. So pragmatism's attempt here to create this sense of uniform, level ground for everybody is what became a very appealing thing for universities and colleges, and think, well, if we do that, then we can maintain enrollments, we're not going to become sectarian. All those things began to pull together. The triumph of pragmatism in voc-tech training, though, could not have happened if the church had not been beginning to fail in its responsibilities. You can have all of these philosophies, you can have all these contexts there, but the church is the thing that holds back the tide of sin and evil in the world. I mean, it's the gift God's given us to do that. And so when things like, you know, today, homosexuality pour in upon us, it means the church is failing. It doesn't mean that they're just more evil than they used to be. It means the church is failing to be salt and light in the way it should have been. And so fathers are not teaching their children the way they should, and their kids are becoming homosexuals. Okay? A tyrannical father or a wimpy father is going to encourage a child in those kinds of directions because they're not showing Christ the way they ought to. And the takeover, if you will, of American higher education was largely the abdication of the church between liberalism and a kind of pietism, anti-intellectualism, where it's, well, we don't really need that. You know, once you've got that education at the primary, secondary level, you're okay. And after all, we just need to go out and save souls. That's all we need to do. Well, you gave away the store doing that. And why did we end up with the collapse of education generally? It's because it starts at the colleges again. What begins at the colleges is going to leach down everywhere else within the education system, whatever it is, and you end up with this nightmare that we live with now. So a sacred-secular dichotomy, okay, that split between my religious beliefs and my job or my education is lethal to us, and it was lethal to that system. It was also, of course, fed by this federal government largesse, your tax dollars going to the land-grant institutions. It was also fed by the giants of industry, people like Carnegie, Leland Stanford, Rockefeller, the DuPonts. As they were beginning to make their millions as the captains of industry, they began to also envision a way of putting off responsibility for training and gaining prestige at the same time. I'll give you just one quick example. Joseph Pulitzer, of the Pulitzer Prize fame, made his money, his millions, as a so-called yellow journalist. He and Randolph Hearst, William Randolph Hearst, he had these scandal sheets that they were publishing in the late 19th century. He made millions. Okay, but the reputation of journalists then and now remains somewhere between used car salesmen and lower. And they were trying to figure out, how do we increase the prestige and status of our journalists and get away from this negative image? Let's start a journalism school. And so he went out to the Ivy League. If he wanted to get prestige, go to the Ivy League. Asked Harvard, Yale, Princeton. He said, I've got $5 million I will give to you if you start a school of journalism. Now remember, this is in a day when $100 a year salary was a lot of money. So $5 million would be like $5 billion today. And he dangled it in front of the Ivy League, and they said, no, don't want it. We're classical Christian schools. We don't do that sort of thing. We don't do that kind of voc tech training. And so they didn't take his money. Except Columbia was in financial trouble. And they went, it won't hurt to have a journalism school. And so they took his money, and so you still have to this day the Columbia School of Journalism, formerly the Pulitzer School of Journalism, and all of that has moved out. Didn't improve the reputation of journalists any. It lowered Columbia's status within the Ivy League immediately. But basically what you had is industrial giants buying into colleges and universities with their money to get programs established to do training for them so they didn't have to do it. I mean, think about it. It's great if I have a business and I don't have to worry about training anybody, but I just push it off to somebody else, let them take all the risks, have all the expenses, and then I get to go pick the best of the crop. What a deal. Okay? And that's basically what we've done in industry today. We have turned all of our universities and colleges into voc tech training centers where the recruiters go to pick the best. And so we have all of these students training in specific fields to hopefully get a job in their picked major. Now, I taught in a journalism school at a land-grant university for 17 years. Believe me, it is a joke. It is a joke. Because these students go through expecting that they're majoring in this field that they might end up in, and a very few actually end up in it. And then once they get in it and they realize, oh, I don't like this. These are rotten hours. They don't pay very much. Well, and then all of a sudden, they're doing something else. But now they have no education and they have no training. I mean, they were trained in something else. I have a computer science friend, PhD, who started a business that did wonderfully. And within 5 years, he was doing absolutely no engineering. He was going around talking to businessmen in Japan about why they should take their chips. And he goes, I need to come over and learn a whole set of new skills about speaking and communicating with people. And I need to understand Japanese history and culture. And all that engineering training didn't help me one bit for what I'm doing now. It was that kind of thing that they don't tell you when they say 60% of our students got jobs when they graduated. They don't tell you how long they stayed in those jobs and so on. The point is that vocational technical training that is taking place and dominating is a big lie within our culture. And when you see the decline of what is happening broadly within our culture, it is connected to this kind of myth about vocational technical education. We have a general decline culturally, and it is connected to that. Just connect the dots. And industry has done that. But I come back to this for you. You have an industry. You have a business, if you will, in the educational field. Why do you expect colleges to train your teachers? Why do you expect that still? Take responsibility for training up your teachers. Take that responsibility. Do not push it off on the colleges, because if you do, what will happen is colleges like New St. Andrews that are trying to be classical Christian schools will at some point have to say, okay, you're all putting pressure on us so that our graduates can get jobs with you, because you won't take them unless they've had 20 credits of educational theory and, you know, testing methods or whatever. If you make us go there, then we will simply become another voc tech school, only in education. But once we've gone there, why not any other major? Right? Where's the breaks for that? And that's basically what happened. As soon as you say, let's go voc tech here, you can go voc tech everywhere and anywhere you want to go, because you have no principle basis to say no. You know, pick a job, pick a field. You should have a voc tech program in that at every university. And you wonder why there's a bloat at universities. It's because of that. Every job in every field has pressure coming down to make that a major, so they don't have to train the people themselves. But that's not a covenantal way of thinking. So specialization has taken command. Specialized training, specialized education. It's interesting that until 18, I was looking for this for a long time, and I finally found it I think it was in David Noble's book, America by Design. The very first college major was not offered in the United States until 1878. Johns Hopkins University. Johns Hopkins. 1878. Think about it. No majors. None. And why was that? Because they were educating in the liberal arts. You didn't have a BA in anything. You had a Bachelor of Arts. You were learning the arts, the trivium and quadrivium, and doing so from a Christian worldview. As soon as you started adding the in something, the game was over. Now you had a specialization at the undergraduate level, and the rush was on to marginalize the liberal arts. Go to any college or university today, any, and you will see enormous pressure brought to bear on the liberal arts faculty to reduce, dumb down, make easier. And if you go to schools of business or engineering, which are huge on most campuses, they will be even more furious with those core curriculum committees and so on, because they won't take off the credits. It's already reduced down to less than 2 years, and then the 2 years of, you know, specialized training or more. But the battle on campuses is the removal of the liberal arts. The University of Idaho, where I taught, they turned the core into one gigantic multicultural experience. The president of the university actually said, I want multiculturalism taught in every core course. And the committee said, I was on the committee. The committee said, mathematics too? He says, absolutely. Every single course has to teach multiculturalism. Okay? And this is in conservative Idaho, in northern Idaho. I mean, you think about it, it is everywhere. It's pandemic. And the core no longer means core of anything except a secularized, ideologically driven worldview. Okay, that's what that is. And again, I say, why do we say, let's train up our kids, you know, in that, rather than thinking about the consistent teaching of a Christian, classical Christian perspective through to the point where their specialization is something they can approach knowledgeably with a godly worldview and being equipped to do that. What has happened is the dissolution of Christian higher education in the process. The success of these land-grant institutions and many of the secular colleges began to carry the day, and we had, within about 50 years, almost all Christian colleges began to offer majors. The pressure was enormous from parents, from peers, from businesses, because they'd say, well, look, I'm having to hire my kids from, you know, the state university over here. I'd love to hire your Christian kids, but you don't have any major in business. What am I going to do with that? You know, you need to have a business major. And soon the colleges all drifted that direction, and it happened very, very quickly. So if you think about it, from 1870 to 1920, and just after World War I, we have that transformation of American higher education to the point where we can hardly think of anything different. You know, we can hardly think about it. And when I do talk to parents, one of the current concerns that always comes back is, well, it is a different world now. And, you know, you have to go do that. If you're going to have a job in this field, you got to go train for that. But, you know, even in the professions like law and medicine, which are exclusively graduate level, they almost always say, do something in the liberal arts. In fact, medical schools now are saying, we'd prefer you to have majored in history or English or something in the liberal arts, because we can teach you the science and stuff, but what we can't do is teach you how to relate to people and understand the history and culture of the people you're going to interact with as a physician. So don't just be a sort of science nerd and do biochem as a undergraduate, maybe a master's in chemistry, and then come on to medical school. No, do something that is more grounded in the liberal arts. So the dissolution of Christian higher education followed right on that same line. And we basically have today a number of problems that are directly connected to the secularization of the higher education system. Professionalism. Christian colleges are now in the same boat as the state universities, because we've basically said what matters most, going back to that leveling thing, you know, making everybody the same, is your professional credentials. If I have an opening in a field, I just go out and I look for the person who has the PhD in the teaching experience. Okay? I don't ask about their Christian worldview. In many places, you can't ask that. That's not allowed. Okay? It's leveled out. So professional credentials and experience are what matter the most, when in fact, biblically, what education is has nothing to do with that at all. Competence is important, but how many degrees you have doesn't matter a whit. Okay? That won't get you through the gate at the last great day because you had a degree in such and such. Okay? That doesn't matter. Competence, character, worldview, those were the things that have been sacrificed. And the reason they have to be sacrificed now is because Christian colleges that offer majors in anything that will get people in the door may have 300 new business majors coming to their Christian college, and they need somebody to teach accounting tomorrow because they've got this huge new freshman class coming in. They need a warm body to teach accounting. And so they go out and they find somebody who was not what they would want. But they've got them. They're enrollment-driven schools. They've got this major. They've got to fill the slot. And so they're not thinking about the first principles. Accreditation, same kind of problem. The standard of accreditation has changed over the years remarkably. And I give a couple of instances in the notes. You have a college in New York, which is predominantly Jewish, was told that they had to have more diversity on their faculty, because even though they had something like, 17%, 18% minorities on their faculty, the student body was 17%. This is a Jewish college, and the president said, this is either McCarthyism or a Kafkaesque trial process. You know, they're coming in and demanding these things of us. And it's like, but we're a Jewish college. Closer to our tradition, Westminster Seminary was denied accreditation because it didn't have women on its board by the Mid-Atlantic states. And it took almost, an act of Congress. It took Secretary of Education to step in on their behalf to say, well, it's okay for a conservative Christian body that doesn't have, that doesn't believe in women ministers to not have women on its board. That's okay. But the accreditation system was driving that. But if you lose your accreditation, what's going to happen? Nothing. Except federal financial aid. And that's the hook everyone has gotten into. The purse strings, follow the money. It's the economy, stupid. Christian colleges have bought wholesale into the federal financial aid system. And what you have is a massive system of financial aid that is absurd, if you really think about it. Most students will graduate today with an average indebtedness nearing $20,000. That's with the federal financial aid. Because what federal financial aid did was initially, it helped out the student and so on, but again, it took the brakes off the colleges. If they can fund everything through federal financial aid, then where are the brakes? Hire more, build more, do whatever you want, because if you up your tuition, guess what? That means you get more financial aid. The government will let you take more. And so you ended up with this system of gross abuse, and you still have like a default rate of like 25% or something ridiculous like that. And it's killing us. It is killing us because there's no accountability for the students and for the schools in the way that there should be. The solution has been that great new process of accountability that we are all required to do now, assessment. Everybody has to go through assessment to prove what you've done with your money. And what's funny is that we are required to do assessment even though we take no money. They don't know what to do with us. We don't take any federal money, but we have to do assessment. We have to have an assessment program because we have to show what happened with the money we don't take. It's rather interesting. But we have to have a plan. We have to have a plan. We must have a plan to assess. And what's also interesting is they require that we have measurable outcomes. They have to be measurable. Show me the numbers, how many percentage of your students got jobs, and so on. You have to prove that there were things, but they have to be proven with data, hard data. Again, the scientific model, scientific mindset, has no idea what education is. The federal financial leviathan has created a system today that I think we are in grave danger at the college level of seeing colleges and universities simply implode. And the first ones that will go will be the Christian institutions. And just think about this. One of the reasons that Bob Jones University lost its 501c3 status several years ago was because, even though I don't like the issue it was fought over, because they were said to violate the basic issues with regard to public policy on discrimination. They were said to discriminate on the basis of race. Well, you know where the battle is now is with homosexuality. If you take federal money, can you discriminate on the basis of sexual preference? if as an institution you discriminate on the basis of sexual preference, they could withdraw your funding. Well, if you've just built your entire institution over the last 75 years or 25 years on that federal financial aid and it goes away, what's going to happen to those schools? They're going to tank really quickly, or they're going to start to look a lot differently. But again, once you've started accepting that stuff, you've already given up the principle. You know, it's sort of like the question of the prostitute. We've already established that they're prostitutes. Now we're just quibbling over the price, right? We're sort of there, okay? We're sort of agreeing that we'll take the money, but we don't want to take it too much, or we don't want to take, you know, too little. We're going to debate how much we take. Once you start there, the principle is already lost. Sure.
You'd charge us with teaching or training our own teachers. Mm-hmm. Is that why you have these training, some teacher training seminars? This one was in about 2 weeks ago, this one at ACCS. Can you just expand a little bit on training your teachers?
Logos School has done that. New St. Andrews had something like that a couple of years ago, but we've moved away from that as well, because that really is properly at the level of the schools themselves. Cary Christian School is doing that now. I think there's several others that are doing it, Veritas and that. So I commend them for doing that, because I think that's helpful to everyone. But I'm not even thinking about it in terms of that kind of programmatic thing for a whole bunch of schools. I'm meaning your school. And because how you do it is different from how another school does it. And it should be. You know, we're not going to cookie cut the whole lot. And so no matter what you learned at some seminar or in some major, they're still going to have to learn how you want it done. How you approach the kids, how you teach, the kind of pedagogy you're developing, and the way you interact, and all of those things are going to be unique to your institution. And those are the things you're going to have to teach anyway. Right? So what we've lost is the whole idea of mentoring and apprenticeship. That's what we've lost. We've assumed schools could do that, and they can't. They do it badly. They just, because it's so abstracted from the world in which it's done. So encouraging schools to get back into raising up their own teachers. Again, you still want qualified people, okay? But the training part of it, to become an educator, is something that has to be done through a nurturing process. And you can't just get a degree in teaching and be a teacher. Okay, so that's part of what I'm encouraging there. Let me just conclude with a number of these smaller items that I'll just touch on, and again you can look up on the website or get a copy of the presentation. But what's happened is colleges being remade in the image of the secular university has meant that we have unlimited majors in principle, unlimited majors at most Christian colleges that are geared towards specialized training, which means they can't do anything very well. You know, they're trying to do all things for all people, and they can't do it well. And it really is killing Christian colleges. I mean, the distinctiveness between a Christian college and the secular university is usually the Christian college doesn't have as much money. That's about it. But there's, you know, and then there's pious words said and all of that, but there's not a fundamental difference in what the shape and character and curriculum and pedagogy is. It's just not different. And we need to repent of that. Okay, we need to get away from that. Enrollment-driven institutions. As long as you have enrollment driving things, you lose. Okay? Because it's a consumer market then. And the students will come in and say, well, we want this. And then the school administrators have to say, whoa, they want that. We don't want them to leave to go somewhere else. We'll have to offer it to them. And then you're back in the position of letting the student enrollment and the majors drive the kind of people you hire. Okay? And so you've lost control of the faculty, which should be the core of your institution. Right? They're the covenant leaders of this process. Okay? They're the ones who guide and direct. And if you lose them by having to just go out and find the warm body to teach the discipline that they're in, you've lost. You've given up the principle from the start. Faculty members as replaceable parts, that idea of the credentials again. You know, PhD gets you in. Okay? PhD, you win. That's not what we should be looking at. Faculty are not replaceable parts. They are people who have worldviews and visions, and they need to be carefully understood and equipped as nurturers, or they shouldn't be there. And that can only happen at your level. They're not replaceable parts. I can't just take one person from over here and plug them into your school just because they had experience. Everybody has experience. But what kind of experience? What did it come with? What was the worldview? Dorms and rec centers, sort of institutionalizing cultural immaturity. If you want to keep the kids happy on campus, okay, what do? Well, if you have an enrollment-driven college, you just keep building more dorms because you've created this enormous city of 18 to 21-year-olds, and they have to be doing something when they're not studying their major. And so you build rec centers and play facilities. And what we see happening more and more on campuses, and you see it reflected even in the literature, when some of your schools and your own kids start getting recruited by colleges, you know, come join us. It's a great pizza party time every Friday night. And you know, and you get that kind of dumbed down idea of what the college experience should be. It's because they're catering to that kind of lowest common denominator of, we just need warm bodies to fill our dorms, and we need more of them because we just built more. And so now we need more students, which means we have to run out and find even more lesser qualified faculty. The federal aid problem again, just a couple quick examples here. At Pepperdine, Malibu U, a historically Christian institution, 67% of its students graduate. This is current this year. 67% of its students graduated with an average debt load of $33,000. That's the average debt. At University of Puget Sound in nearby Tacoma for us, the graduates there were 60% of the graduates had a debt of $24,000. At Simpson College in Iowa, 91% of the graduates had a debt of over $20,000. Okay? And that's with the federal financial aid system in place. Okay? So it's often not really aid. What it is loans. Okay? And they don't really tell you about the parameters of that. And what we have is a generation of college students graduating who are enslaved. They are enslaved from the beginning to the federal government. So it's not an aid system, it's a slavery system. Okay? So the federal government wanted to recreate the world in 1862 and get rid of slavery. It just wanted to change the slave owner. Career placement is the other thing. We have colleges spending enormous amounts of money on career placement offices. Okay? Because if you go down that road of being a job trainings program, you have to get them out there. So they have to be the people who are going out bringing the recruiters onto campus and helping kids with their resumes and doing all of that sort of thing. So basically what we have is a works project, okay? A federally funded works project. This is the WPA, okay? Masquerading as university education. The reformation of Christian higher education is tied to you and the classical Christian school movement in an extraordinarily integral way. What happens at the college level is going to come downstream to you. Okay? It'll be in the teachers you have. It'll be in the people that move into your communities and join your churches. It will be on your doorstep. Okay? It is not something that is distant. It's not something that you've done your job when the kids graduate from your high school and go off to college. Okay? It's just beginning. Okay? So I encourage you to think reformationally about higher education and to think about it in the context of these other things. We are thinking about the reformation of the church always, right? how to be more biblical, more grounded. We're concerned about that as Christians. That's an easy one. We're always wanting to be reforming there. We're reforming education. We're trying to recover the classical vision of Christian education. So we want that kind of change and revival to continue through conferences like this. But we've not thought about higher education enough, and we've really not thought about the reformation of business and how the next generation of workers is brought up, again, biblically, Christianly. And that's where I think you need to also encourage people in your churches and schools that are connected to you that are in business to think, what are you doing to help bring that next generation on? If you demand the universities do that job for you, then we are going to continue to have the pressure to dumb down what we're doing at your level, whatever it is, okay? Because it'll be more pressure for voc-tech orientation and less of the education that we want our children to have. So it's crucial that we encourage people to think not just about education, not just about the church, but every area of life has to be rethought from the ground up biblically, or we are all in this trouble together. Okay? Now, I know there are lots of practical issues here. I know that. But we need to start thinking about the principles that should be directing our approaches to these things. Obviously, if we begin with the worst-case scenarios, the tough issues, like, well, my kid wants to be an engineer. Okay, I understand that professionalism has got its teeth into other things to where you have to go get specialized education and get licensed and all those sorts of things. Those are other problems, like the reformation of government. We have to get the government out of some of those things. But we start with where we can, and we start with the obvious areas where bringing interns and apprentices in and helping them do it, even while they're getting their classical education. There's nothing wrong with that. But we need to start thinking about vocation and education as not at war with each other and one not displacing the other, but working together in a way where we don't dumb down the education, where we build a Christian worldview in our children's being, so that when they enter their vocations, they are leaders in godly work for the kingdom of God and not just repeating the same secular paradigms that they received at their secular institutions. So let me open it up to questions.
I just want one question.
Sure. Our graduates are roughly broken out in thirds. So about a third go on to graduate school with some kind of specialization, a third go on and teach, and a third do everything else. Have babies, take over family businesses, go back to the family farm, whatever it is. So it breaks about a third. And what's interesting is that with no specialization at our college, we have no majors, we've ended up seeing our students finish somewhere in the range of 90th percentile on the GRE, graduate record exam. They can get into anything they want to. and they're sort of really prized that way because they are so well educated broadly and deeply that the specialists are happy to get people like that. So it actually works the other way around. One other interesting thing in that vein is that even if you take a pragmatic approach and say, well, you know, they'd make so much more money if they just got into engineering right away, not long term, because again, like my friend, the PhD in, you know, computer engineering, you know, he would have been far better served and advanced even more in his field had he had that background. Right. So the people who end up in the management levels 10, 15 years out are the people who are much better educated, and the technical drones are still doing what they entered at 10 years later because they can't advance beyond the technical skill level. Yeah?
Did you think some other colleges in the nation that are resisting these?
No, they're all competitors. No. let's see, Patrick Henry has a mixed bag on that because they are starting, they've started offering majors, and that's already beginning to proliferate on them. But they do have a classics program. Probably the one Protestant one that's doing the most right now is probably the Torrey Institute at Biola. But then there are some of the Roman Catholic schools like Thomas Aquinas and Magdalene College. There's quite a few Roman Catholic schools that are maintaining that. They're the conservative Roman Catholic schools that have actually led on this in ways that the Protestants should have. There's not a lot of them. It's kind of interesting when you start to look on our website, there's an ACT CollegeNet search thing, and you can search by region, by the amount of money you spend, by the size of the institutions. The number of colleges that are small and under like 20,000, it's like, 600. I mean, it's really tiny. There's, everything is just bloated out in the higher education system, and that creates problems for these institutions to offer something like just the liberal arts classics programs, because they're not economically attractive for the big numbers. Mm-hmm. It varies from year to year. This year we'll have probably, I'm guessing, 70 applicants, 80 applicants, something like that. We tend to be kind of self-selecting too. I mean, nobody in their right mind would come to New St. Andrews if they were just thinking about college in general. we're not on the same list as Michigan State and, those sorts of things, so we tend to not get the same applicant. Yeah. I don't know detail on the whole period there, but I know that Harvard in 1643, in order to get in, you had to stand before the faculty and be able to parse and recite in Greek and Latin the key authors, and you had to know Greek and Latin inside out and backward, and know the classic authors. I mean, they would judge you based on how well you did that, not just could you, how well you did that. And that's why I say, if you have that as any kind of criterion for getting into college today, most college graduates couldn't do that. Yeah?
Also interesting, most of those college interns went in without.
Yeah. When John Locke graduated, or actually when John Locke entered Oxford in 1640-something, or actually a little earlier, he was dubbed the old man. He was 17. Most of his classmates entering Oxford that year were 14 years old. And they were able to get in because they could do all of those things in Greek and Latin. So that's why I say, if you're comparing yourself to today, you win. If you compare yourself to a few hundred years ago, well, you look really bad. Yeah. I don't have that. I'm sure it would be it still would be remarkable. Smaller. Yeah, see, I would couch it differently. I would say we're not trying to do a class thing. That's the criticism. But I would say what we want are people who are qualified because they did their work at a younger age. So if I have a student who cannot read and write, I'm not admitting him to New St. Andrews. I don't care if he's, you know, a child left behind. It's like, that's not my issue. And so the question is, do we want to return to high standards, and do we want to push everybody up in the process, or do we keep taking the lowest of the, you know, the bottom and lowering everything? So we have to raise the bar considerably, otherwise we're in trouble. That other thing is that college is not for everyone.
Okay,
so. You know, we charge, at New St. Andrews, we take no federal financial aid. We charge one-third the average of their colleges that are on federal financial aid. So the average right now is $18,273. I like those specific numbers. That's the average of private colleges today for tuition. We charged $6,000 this last year. Okay, and the reason we can is because we don't take federal money. I mean, that's the trade-off. But, you know, again, the whole system is corrupted, and I understand there are transitional problems, there are specific things like you're talking about. But, yeah, money is always an issue, and we have allowed the federal government to take this question over for us so that we don't even think about it. I mean, when we think about sending our kids off to college, we just think, well, we hope they get scholarships and they can get some loans and aid. And we're not thinking about where that's coming from, how that's connected, what it's done to the college. You know, we just don't think about that. And so we really do need to keep putting, you know, this into the minds of everyone from the church through educators and down to think about a different structure to how we approach this. How to get a hand up. Yeah.
Which you can do in the tuition of $6,000. You can't. It's a lot harder to put stuff in school at $20,000 a year.
Yep. Again, I'm sorry I didn't have enough handouts, but if you go to the website, I'll get that up next week sometime. So thank you.